Claude Steiner is my guest on Dealing Today. He has written a very interesting new book entitled Scripts People Live, Transactional Analysis of Life Scripts. First of all, I'd like to ask you your background, to let our audience know how you were trained and where
Well, my background, as far as this book goes, is that I was acquainted with, or I met Eric Byrne in 1957. At the very beginning of his work, when he gave up being a psychoanalyst and started developing transactional analysis. At that time, I was an undergraduate, and because of my interest in him and his interest in me, I then went
you
on.
You fell in love.
We kind of fell in love, yes. Really. We were very good friends. I went on to become a psychologist. So I went to school and I got a PhD in psychology in order to be able to be a psychotherapist. In those days, you needed to have a degree, to do psychotherapy. And then proceeded to work with Eric until he died in 1971. And then since then, I've been working on making it possible for people to do psychotherapy without degrees. Good psychotherapy.
Okay, are you moving towards doing psychotherapy without psychotherapists?
No, because I think that there's a definite skill. I mean, it's you have to really have some knowledge and some expertise as a psychotherapist, even though we all, I think, are able to achieve that. All of those who are interested could, without having to go through some extensive schooling. But I think that in the end, there is an expertise, and I would call that expertise psychotherapy. So it's not although the long term goal of the movement that I'm with, the radical therapy movement, is that everybody will be an expert, with people and able to help other people, so that you don't need the professionals, and especially you don't need to pay, which is really the worst part of psychotherapy, is that it's so expensive.
There, at least in Los Angeles at any rate, are large centers now that are starting where they're training paraprofessionals to do, I guess, low-key counseling, smaller mm-hmm. problems, mm-hmm. And then they have group sessions afterwards where the paraprofessionals can consult with the professionals, mm-hmm. which seems to be kind of a way out of this financial morass, mm-hmm. which is $40 or $50 an hour. Twice or once a week seems to me to be a very, very high price to pay for a normal person having normal problems.
It's outrageous, I think. I don't like the idea that people have to eventually consult with the professionals, because I don't think the professionals, are really that, necessarily that competent as therapists. I mean, I talk about that in the book. I speak about the fact that I feel that most of what's available in the way of psychiatry in this country is not very good, and then people are always being told, go see a psychiatrist, and then the mental health associations wonder why people don't, and they somehow assume that people don't go to see psychiatrists because there's something wrong with them.
Hence the term shrink.
I think it shows good sense. I think most people will stay away from psychiatrists because what is done by most psychiatrists is not very helpful.
I have a question. How I would like to approach it, since it's a very, very complex subject, and it's a very readable book, but it's very complex. It's not something that you can just, it's not bathroom reading. Mm-hmm. You have to really sit down and read from the beginning to the end. Let's just pretend that nobody knows anything about transactional analysis, okay? And maybe we could talk a little bit about that and how that grew into the scripts aspect, which is what you developed from the I'm okay, you're okay thesis.
Okay, I'll tell you about the thing is that Eric Byrne developed this theory called transactional analysis in the late 50s. And there's several very important parts of that theory. One of them is the notion that people are okay. And that's where I'm okay, you're okay comes from. It's something that was coined by Eric Byrne, and it's probably the most important concept in transactional analysis, which is that people are okay. The people are born okay. And that when they get into difficulties, it's not because there's something wrong with them inside of them, but because of their transactions with other people. That is, the troubles are not inside of people, they're between people.
What does this do to the concept, which I thought was gaining importance in psychological and psychiatric schools, of personal responsibility for one's own action?
Well, one, we have personal responsibility, but it comes from knowing that we can change our lives, not that there's something wrong with us.
In other words, it's not the internal defect that's your own fault, but it is something that you can change.
No, you can change everything. That's the idea of scripts. The other very important concept in transactional analysis is that people live their lives according to plans which were set early in childhood or early adolescence, so that we do the things that we do because we kind of decided to do them that way because we were pretty much forced or pretty much pressured into doing them by our parents and schools and the media. I mean, the whole society conspires to kind of force us to behave in certain ways, certain very specific ways, which we call scripts. And then from then on in, we live our lives according to a script. We just read the lines, you know, that are given us. And we have these different things that we do. You know, we have to go to school. We have to become either a doctor, a lawyer, or engineer if we're going to be successful. And if we're not so successful, you know, then we do other things. And if we're men, we're supposed to be, you know, tough and unemotional and rational. And if we're women, we're supposed to be, you're supposed to be emotional and illogical and
except
and
now
weak.
The women's movement is writing its own script in
right.
reality for women and making
right.
many housewives
right.
feel that they are not okay.
Oh, right. It's well, the
Some,
women's well. What's happening is that women have decided that all of these things that they were told about themselves weren't really true, and they were very oppressive, and they've come to the conclusion that no, they don't have to be passive. They don't have to be unable to think and talk, and they don't have to be super emotional. They can be just as rational as men, and just as tough, and just as whatever.
And just as stupid and everything
you know,
else.
Whatever, right.
right. Let's get back to transactional analysis for a second about the parent, child, adult. He divided up.
Proposed that one good way of looking at people is that there's three very important parts, ego states. One is the parent, one is the adult, one is the child. And that we act from these different parts of our personality at different times.
Adults, that is, not children.
Grown-ups. Children, too. Children have parents, adults, and childs, too.
Really?
Sure. My 10-year-old son, when he was 5 years old, sometimes would come on like I did, in a very authoritarian, perhaps, way. Sometimes he would be quite rational. You know, think things through, and sometimes it would be a little kind of a baby.
Well, and I can see how they would do the parent trip on younger siblings.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And my daughter is older than my son. Parents him a lot, and he reacts as a child to her a lot, even though they're both children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and at the same time, they also are able to be adult. That is, adult means rational. It doesn't mean grown up. It's not a very good word. Best way of thinking of it, but it means rational. It means
well,
logical.
Isn't there? What is he saying then? That there should be a balance between adult, parent, and child, or that it should be mainly adult and with the suppression of the parent and the child in a continuous ego state.
All three ego states are very valuable in different situations. We need them all to be complete human beings. If we put anything and make it dominant to the others, then we are going to be wasting our potential. Our potential to be nurturing parents is very important. To be nurturing, taking care of, loving in that particular parental way.
That is, maybe we should define then, that the parental means nourishing to someone else, whether it be a lover or somebody older or younger or whatever
right.
it is. And then what is the child like?
The
fun-loving?
The childlike is like spontaneous, creative, generative, recreative. In other words, it's pretty much a
spontaneous
state. It also is the only way that we know whether we're doing what we really want to do. And it's when we talk about scripts and how we do things according to other people's ideas, the way we learn about how to, what it is, I mean, very often we do things, we don't know why we're doing them. Well, the way to know whether you're doing something you want to do is to really tune into the child part of you that will eventually tell you.
Is it fun?
Is this what you want?
Yeah.
You know, is this relationship what I want? Do I want to have children? Do I want to be married? Do I want to be an engineer? Do I want to be an alcoholic? All the different things we do without, you know, do I want to smoke? Do I want to overeat? It's only the child But the child, according to Byrne, is okay. The child knows what's best. This is the important concept. See, we can tune into ourselves to find out what is best for us and also for other people.
But just because it feels okay and it makes you happy, should that be the sole determining factor for whether or not you do something? For example, if a father is responsible, the mother's dead and he's responsible to raise the children, and he decides parental-wise, adult-wise, it's his responsibility to maintain a job and whatever and take care of the kids, but the child in him says, I want to go to Acapulco and find myself, you know.
Yeah.
And that's really what's going to feel good for me, because I don't want the responsibility of this kid or whatever. I mean, where do duties fit into this?
Well, I mean, the example you bring up is very interesting, because I have two children and I'm bringing them up. And I had the same tendency to say, I want to get away from the kids. Well, I did. I took care of them. I got away. I mean, I want to take care of the children, not because I want to take care of them so much as because it turns me on. The whole thing turns me on. They take care of me. See, one of the things that happens when you get into scripts is there is a script for parents, which is to absolutely take care of the kids. And there's a script for children, which is to be taken care of. Well,
Or to take care of themselves.
Well, basically, children expect to be taken care of by their parents. But that isn't necessarily the way to do it. The way I do it with my children is they take good care of themselves, I take good care of them, and they take care of me. You know, they do things for me. I expect them to do things for me. So in the end, we're all kind of doing what we want to do. You know, basically, I'm happy with the situation. They're happy with the situation. And it is not the normal script for a father taking care of his children, mm-hmm. if you take a close look at it.
Would this kind of arrangement, not specifically yours, but this kind of tolerance towards children, tend to support the thesis that in Victorian times that children were really little adults, more than they were some beings that are sort of ignorant that one has to put up with and tolerate and sort of mold to one's own image or whatever one wishes to mold the children to?
I think that the idea of them being little adults is that they were supposed to be little civilized adults. You know, they were to be civilized right as they came out of their wombs.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, civilized, more and more we're beginning to see, is not such a good thing.
Or is not rational, maybe. I mean, polite is not rational.
Polite isn't good, you know. Mm-hmm. Polite. I've raised my children to be disobedient children. I don't want my children to be obedient. I want them to ask for what they want and choose what they want and complain when they don't get what they want. And I never want them to do anything out of obedience. I want them to do it out of love for me or not do it. And so obedience, which is like the civilized aspect of people, is a script. You know, you obey. In fact, script, the whole idea of being in a script implies you're being obedient to other people's ideas. That isn't right.
Or society's
ideas. Society.
Let's talk about the different scripts. You outline in your book three, well, I guess they're essentially tragic scripts: depression, madness, and drug addiction.
Yeah.
Depression meaning no love. I'm reading from my notes. Madness meaning no mind, and drug addiction being no joy. How people then obviously have to be trained by their own little society, their family, or by mm-hmm. society as a whole, not to love or to be stupid or to have very much fun.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you learn your scripts as a child.
Yeah, for instance, when it comes to the depression script, which is the depression, by and large in this country, comes from the fact that we do not get that we do not have any kind of satisfactory loving relationships, so that a lot of people simply not successful in their loving. In their love lives, that is, not only their sexual love lives, but their love lives between brothers and sisters, father, you know, parents and children, and lovers. That is all the result of a very systematic training in childhood that really defeats us in our loving capacities. You know, we are trained out of every possible way of being loving. You know, we, for instance, have difficulty giving strokes. Strokes in transactional analysis is the word for love. A loving exchange is an exchange of strokes. Children are taught not to freely give strokes. That is, you don't walk up to somebody and stroke them. You know, you have to be very careful. they're taught not to ask for strokes. They're taught not to accept strokes when they're given. They're told that if somebody says something nice about you, you should be modest. You should kind of deflect it. You're told as a child not to reject strokes you don't want. That is, you're supposed to take strokes you don't want. And in the end, when you're told that children aren't supposed to touch grown-ups, grown-ups aren't supposed to touch children. You're told that boys aren't supposed to touch girls, and girls aren't supposed, you know, I mean, all these rules about touch and affection, which by the time we grow up leave us completely unable to be loving. And these rules especially affect men, so that men are especially incapable of being loving. And so we find when people come to therapy, women are very depressed because their relationships with men are a continuous series of disappointments. Men who come to therapy after having a few failures, you know, love in their love lives.
By the way, men are also trained in our society not to stroke each other physically.
Oh, yes. Men generally speaking are absolutely incapable of giving strokes. They're more capable of taking them. And what happens in relationships between men and women is that the strokes go from the women to the men. That is, the women are trained to give but not ask for or take. The men are trained to take but not give. And a tremendous imbalance develops, which in a few years becomes so difficult for both parties to bear that it breaks the relationship down. And you find women constantly complaining in therapy that the men aren't loving, you know. And men complaining that they don't feel love. They don't even know what it is, let alone how to do it, you know. So that is one of, say, the scripts that are kind of imposed on children that later in life develop into
depression,
which is a script. And when the depression is very severe, it can become a tragic script. I mean, the most depressed, the very, very depressed people feel so bad about themselves that they want to kill themselves, and many do in the end kill themselves. So that's how it goes.
Is the depression script the tragic life script necessarily?
No,
or can you just be...
Depression is one of the things that happens to people. There's two levels of it. There's the banal depression, which is just about everybody is not happy in their loving relationships. They may for periods of time, but over a long pull, very few people can say, I've had a life that is full of love, you know, where I've given and taken and been very satisfied and been very satisfying. So that's the idea of depression. Now, there's banal levels of it, and there's tragic levels of it. The same thing with mindlessness. There is banal levels of mindlessness, which is people not being able to think straight, and it especially affects women. Women are trained from childhood not to be, you know, thinkers.
Not to be on top of it.
Not to be on top of it. Not to be able to balance the checkbook. Not to be able to think through a situation. Well, the extreme of mindlessness, that's the banal level of it. The extreme tragic level of it is the... Is madness, you know, total madness, which is called schizophrenia by the psychiatric profession. And then once again, there's another area of disturbance, which is the joylessness, the fact that we aren't in touch with the pleasures that our body could afford us. And at the banal level, it means that we're constantly taking drugs to make us feel better, either aspirin to improve our headaches or alcohol to relax us, all of these drugs.
Sugar, tobacco,
all the drugs, coffee, are in one way or another an attempt to make us feel better. Whereas we wouldn't have to take any drugs if we could be in touch with our bodies and we had them and we took care of them, we would be able to feel the joy of our body without the drugs. Okay, so at the banal level, we're just kind of consuming drugs all the time. At the more tragic level, we become addicts. We become alcoholics, heroin addicts, or, you know, really, really hooked cigarette addicts.
You wrote a book, Games Alcoholics Play, which I didn't get a copy of, which I would have liked to have read very much. This book grew out of that book.
Yeah, it's specifically the book about alcoholism is about the alcoholic script and the therapy of it. You know, in other words, I speak about it about the specific problem of alcoholism and how it is a script.
It's not. I would think it.
It's the
it would be tied in with
joylessness.
With joylessness, but also to the depression, the no love.
Well, very. I mean, these scripts. You don't only have one of these. You can be.
You can one can be superimposed on the other.
You can be joyless and mindless and loveless. You know,
you
but
have three stars in your life movie.
You could have all of these. Generally, people tend to settle on one and have the others as kind of satellites.
Subplots,
yes. So
about the alcoholic, how is he trained specifically? Because
alcoholic,
or is it just could it have been dope just as well as alcohol? Had that person come into dope?
Well, most alcoholics come from families where there's alcoholism. That's the first thing. They also come from a society where drugs are constantly pushed, constantly promoted, and used for achieving well-being. And so very early in life, alcoholics, people who eventually become alcoholics, learn how drugs are a shortcut to good feelings. And if anything is going wrong, rather than to deal with the situation, they will, alcohol will become the direct route to doing whatever needs to be done. Alcohol, unfortunately, is very addictive. So in time...
Psychologically or physiologically?
Physiologically. It's extremely addictive physiologically. And so after a time, you know, you have to have it. And you aren't able even to stop and think, so to speak, to actually make yourself feel better without the drug. So you become hooked. But alcoholism is just one of the many things that people are afflicted by, which can be actually disposed of. That is, it's something you start doing by decision, and you can stop doing it by decision.
Once you get beyond the physiological problems, you would have to go through a period of physical withdrawal.
Right.
But you have to psychologically want to withdraw, obviously.
Right. I mean, there is a real strong physical addiction, which you have to beat first, and then after that, you have the much bigger problem, which is to beat the fact that you are accustomed and have to deal with every situation by drinking.
One of the tragedies of all these tragic life scripts is that, obviously, if you're trained to do them, you have to untrain yourself, either with the help, am I correct, with a therapist or maybe even working with yourself. But it seems to me like you can really get into a vicious cycle. It's very, very difficult to break. For example, in depression, if you're trained to reject strokes and you can't get strokes, you make yourself a person that nobody would want to give strokes to anyway. So how all of a sudden are you going to be a lovable person?
This is why we need, I mean, this is why the kind of work we do is done in groups. Because it's not possible to come out of any of these holes that we dig for ourselves by yourself. Or even just with one therapist. In other words, you need a group of people who are going to be supportive and who are going to give you the encouragement and the backup and the feeling that you're a good person and that you're worthwhile.
Is there room for any kind of exposure of BS? I mean, is there any kind of room for this kind of group to criticize?
These groups are very supportive and at the same time very critical, in the sense that they will be very criticism, adult criticism, that is rational criticism, is different from accusation or insult. And these groups, whereas in my groups I never allow assault or verbal assault or accusation or insult, we rely very strongly on adult criticism.
Because that was very fashionable when groups first started, was just ripping everybody else apart.
The influence of Synanon on the group therapy movement was that there was a certain technique called attack, which supposedly is of value. I do not find it of value. In fact, I really speak very strongly against it in the book. Attack or assault, verbal assault, is most destructive as far as I'm concerned. Now, that isn't to say that criticism, adult logical criticism, is indispensable. But I don't allow people. I mean, if anyone starts yelling or screaming, I, which is very seldom, by the way, I will usually say that it's not I don't like it, and I wish the thing could be settled some other way.
Do you ever kick a person out of a group
for that?
Well, no, for repeated, you know.
No, the only reason that I would ask somebody to leave a group is because they are not working on their contract. Now, I didn't mention contracts before, but transactional analysis is a contractual form of therapy where people come, they come to the therapist asking for something. You know, the therapist does not assume or presume to tell anyone what's wrong with them. You know, a person has to come in and say, I have this and this unhappiness and I want you to help me with it. Okay, then we make a contract about what it is they want to change. Okay, now if a person comes to therapy and if they don't want to have a contract, I don't work with them. If they make a contract and they don't work on it, and repeatedly don't work on it, and refuse to work on it, then I will ask them to leave the group.
Because that means that they aren't really interested in
the They're not interested
themselves.
In the therapy. That happens very, very seldom. And it only happens when somebody's forced into therapy in some way by somebody else. For instance, sometimes a judge will sentence somebody to being in therapy. So they'll come and they'll say, well, you know, the judge says I should be in therapy, and I guess I want to stop drinking. Well, it becomes very obvious within a couple of weeks that the person isn't really interested. And then they just become a drag on the group. Or somebody's husband or wife will come because they're being threatened with divorce. But that's very seldom. I mean, I have actually, in all of my years, only have had really basically forced two people out of group because they weren't working on their contracts. Most other people...
Are there something that you sign, or is it just, I mean, what...
No, it's a verbal agreement with the rest of the people. I mean, there's eight people in the group and myself, and maybe a co-therapist. We all know exactly what it is the person said they want to work on, and we keep on it. You know, we stay on it. That's one of the reasons people get better.
Okay, well, that I can see how that would help with strokes, or love and depression and giving joy to a person with regard to, say, drug addiction or some other kind of addiction, alcohol or something. But what about mindlessness? I mean, do you work on that in groups
oh,
where
sure.
you try to get people to think straight?
Sure. I mean, one of the things that we learned is that in childhood, there is a very strong training for mindlessness. Parents train their children to be mindless, and they train the girls more severely than the boys. The two most important ways in which parents train their children to be mindless, not to be able to think, is one, they lie to them. You know, they do not speak the truth. Now, one of the most confusing things for any person would be to be lied to without knowing that they're being lied to. In other words, all of the explanations that are given to children by their parents are usually half-baked or almost, or you know, or half-lies or half-truths, and confuse children a great deal about some of the most important things. For instance, one of the most important things to children is what goes on between mom and dad, because that's their life, you know. Their parents are their life. Well, parents are always lying to their kids about what goes on. They certainly do not expose any of their sexual situations or their interpersonal situations. They tend to mystify and mask what happens. That's one very important way in which we lie to our children. The other way...
Wouldn't it be kind of traumatic sometimes for a child to be exposed to any kind of very serious personal problems between parents? If they're trying to solve them, I mean, why involve the child?
It wouldn't be if it was done from the beginning. It would be if suddenly, if for, say, 7 years you've been lying to your kids about what's going on, and which is what always happens. Parents lie for years and years, and then they suddenly say it's all over, you know? But let's say you, from the very first day of your child's life, you spoke about everything that you speak with anyone in front of them just as well. You know, they wouldn't be traumatic at all. They would get a real education in human interaction, and they would probably be able to make their own minds up and to contribute to it, as a matter of fact.
Well, did you say, gee whiz, mom's addicted to drugs, and she's smoking dope and shooting up all the time, and then little Susie runs next door and tells her friend who... you know, has mom put in jail. I mean, I can see some of the values of being upfront with your kids, but there are
some... This is a little extreme. I mean, if you're doing something that goes against the law, then you also should teach your children that you're probably going to teach them disrespect for the law anyway, and some of the law should be disrespected in any case. So that I don't think that that's the main point. I mean, that's a very extreme example. I'm talking about, you know, when you are having a hassle with your wife and you don't stop talking because the kids come in, you're talking to your wife about sex, you don't stop talking because the kids...
Well, I don't know. I don't think that was something that I just pulled out of my head because it was very radical. But, I mean, I think that, for example, if mom or dad is, quote, fooling around, unquote, and wouldn't Mrs. Jones next door just love to find out? I mean, there are so many things that happen between two adults that I question whether or not discussing it in an adult, well, quote, rational, you, unquote, way with a child is going to, I'm sure the child would be interested in it, and so would everybody else the child would talk to, you know?
Well, it depends what you want. If you want kids who are going to think straight, then I think you're in a position of having to consider whether it might not be a good thing. Because if you're not talking straight to the kids, you're going to confuse them. That's my point, you mm-hmm. see?
I mean, well, I get your point, but I also see the dangers of your point, depending on certain lifestyles and...
I think that there are dangers in bringing up children who are not scripted. I mean, children are supposed to be seen and not heard. And you bring up children up that way, that is, then you don't consider them full human beings, they'll fit into the society, but there's dangers there too. In other words, you got to pick between whether you want to bring up kids who are autonomous, who can think, or whether you want to bring up children who fit in real well, or who won't go to the neighbors. I mean, I am talking from experience here. I don't find my kids going to the neighbors. The kids know perfectly well the neighbors couldn't handle the information that they hear in my conversations, you know, with other grown-ups. So they don't go. They don't tell the neighbors. You know, the kids know. They understand. I find it works very well to treat children completely as if they were grown-ups in regard to all the information. The other thing that we do to make children unable to think is we discount them. We do not consider them capable of thinking, and we do not ask them questions. We do not consider their opinions, and we do not deal with their questions in a real way. You know, we tend to skirt around whatever it is that they talk about. So as parents treat children that way, and as schools treat children that way, they grow up being quite unable to think straight mm-hmm. and having real difficulties. And like I said, again, the females of the society are more severely trained that way than the men.
Which, you know, really, that idea of women... being sort of channeled into madness or mindlessness, mm-hmm. depending on if it's going to be a banal or a tragic mm-hmm. life script, is really very tightly related to the depression, you know, or the no love thing we were talking about before in men, because they are trained to stroke the male ego and be mindless, while the men are trained to do the thinking, but not to stroke the mm-hmm. female.
Right. It becomes... These are two complementary scripts, the men and women scripts, where the women can't think and the men can't love.
Is this American?
This is very American, but it's also Western, you know, Western. And it's really not at all restricted to the United States. But it's especially become a problem in the United States because some of the compensations that there used to be for sexism and sex role, you know, the way people were divided up into two kinds of people, men and women, there used to be compensations for this, you know. That is, the men would take care of the women, you know. And there was also sometimes good reasons in the, you know, in a pioneer situation where the division of roles was sensible. But now there's no rewards for it. There's no need for men and women to be different types of human beings. Of course, people are rebelling. You know, women are rebelling against that, and men are beginning to rebel against their side of the scripting, which is that they're supposed to be tough and work hard and be totally responsible and you know, take care of everyone. Men are beginning to say, well, women are going to get their ways. Well, we want our ways too, which is we don't want to have to work so hard. We don't want to have to be responsible for everything.
Which is one of the things that, her name escapes me.
Chesler?
No, the one that wrote the book about how saying that women had manipulated men into being slaves, into doing all the work, while they were sitting home eating bonbons, and how very much more clever women were than men, because they had trained men from the dawn of, you know, time to get out there and hustle the buck. You know, I certainly don't agree with her, but
It's a little lopsided view of things, I think.
But why did you say pioneer times? You said, you know, earlier times. Men are stronger?
I find that when I go out to the mountains, I'm struggling very hard not to be stuck in my banal male roles. And I feel that I've succeeded considerably, you know, that I'm not a kind of a channeled male. that I have choices in my life, that I can be, I can cry and I feel loving feelings, and I don't have to take care of everything, and I don't always have to dominate every situation. And yet, when I go out in the mountains with a woman, we break down into the roles, because I am stronger physically. I can pick up more wood, for instance, if we're going to go gathering wood. I can bring back more wood than she can.
You haven't gone camping with me.
Right. And I think that, you know, as a matter of fact, the more I think of, I mean, I think that women's bodies are already adapted to their roles. I think that women's shoulders are narrower, their arms are weaker. That's all because of scripting.
Earlier scripting, you mean?
Yeah, right. That actually, if I think of it, my daughter's got huge shoulders and big arms, and she loves them. And I think I could still carry more wood than she can, but it doesn't really make that much difference. I think that the breaking down into sex roles makes a certain amount of sense in a more primitive environment, because there is a certain amount of difference in strength that is really true.
But that, again, is sort of a vicious cycle if one would adopt your...
Yes, I think so. I think that certainly in our society as it stands today, the differences between men and women are, are
mainly minimal. Because most of us don't do very much physical work.
Right. I
shouldn't say that. A lot of us do physical work, but...
We can all do the same kind. I mean, no one goes around carrying 100 pounds of cement anymore. That type of work we don't do. The physical work we do...
Or large pyramid stones.
Right. The physical work we do is more skilled work, and men and women are equally skilled. There's some differences between men and women. It's just that they're so exaggerated by sex roles and so exploited, you know. Women's nurturing. I think that there was a thing in psychology today in this recent issue where it appears that men and women have certain emotional differences too. And one can't really argue that there, and it's very difficult to take the position that there are no differences. But the point I make in the book, is the differences are exaggerated and distorted and exploited.
And can be changed.
And that basically men and women are, you know, equal, and that they cannot, and they don't, and that the things that usually happen, namely women can't think straight and men can't feel, are things that people can overcome very easily, give up. In their scripts.
Does a woman have to go back to school? I mean,
sometimes,
you know, no, but I mean, you know, there's a certain organization or a certain way of attack. There are certain learning skills, they call them attack skills in the ed biz, you know, and I know for that reason, like a lot of women don't go into math or into the sciences. They're always pushed towards poetry and music and... What is it? Just a state of confusion?
I think that there's this belief that certain things you learn in school help you to think. I think that most of the things you learn in school don't help you to think. They help you not to think. For instance, all of the writing that people do in school is one of the most damaging to writing skills. You know, I know that it took me years to overcome all the things I learned in school about writing that really damaged my writing. And when I teach people to write, I make that clear. I don't think school is the place to learn to think. The place to learn to think is everyday life, you know. And I doubt very much that the idea is for women to go back to school, except to get the professional degrees and the licenses, so they can be equal to the men professionally, you know, if that's what they want to do. I don't think that's necessary, though. I find that in the work, you know, in the training that we've been doing of men and women in therapy to become therapists, there's no difference between the way men and women think.
The confusion is self-inflicted or inflicted by society.
It's the feeling that women have that they can think. It's like you pull out your a woman pulls out her checkbook and she's gonna balance it, right? Her first thought is, I can't do this, you know. I'm a woman, I'm not that smart, I can't do it. I better just kind of fudge it, you know. A man never doubts that he can add. This has got nothing to do with their skills. It has something to do with their expectations, their scripts. You know, if a baby is crying, if a child hurts himself, the man will immediately think, well, I can't take care of this. This is something that I just don't know how to do, and I can't do it. Whereas a woman naturally flows into doing it. Again, the scripts, you know.
Do all of these scripts that you talk about, the depression script and the madness script and the drug addiction script, how do they relate to personal power? and a kind of a take charge attitude over your own life? Don't they all involve some kind of a desire to really influence your life more than it's influenced by circumstances and other people?
I think that we all come to some point in life where we are willing to recognize the fact that we're not living our own lives. This could happen earlier or later, you know.
Whose lives are we living?
We're living somebody else's lives. We're living scripts, other people's ideas of what should be going on. And if we, for instance, I'm sure that many people who read this book are going to recognize things they're doing that they really don't want to do. And they're going to be confronted with the fact that they're not really doing what they want to do, and that they're really powerless. They have been powerless. They have not exercised their power to live in a free way. So then comes the confrontation. And at that point, some people feel that they have absolutely no power to change things. And some people feel that, yes, once they recognize what's going on, they can change things. So one of the very important things that we learn as children is whether we have power or not, whether we can take our destiny in our own hands and change it. And some people are fortunate in that their parents tell them, you're a strong person, you can do it, you know, you have the capacity to change. And some people are told they can't. So that makes a difference when the confrontation comes. Because to change our ways, to change our preordained scripts, we have to exercise some power. We have to really take things in hand to stop drinking if you're an alcoholic, or to stop
being depressed.
Being depressed, or to start looking for the strokes that you need, or to really concentrate and think, you know, when you need to, or to change your sexual behavior. You know, a lot of the therapy that is going on along these lines has to do with the fact that women's sexuality is completely scripted. And when a woman begins to get in touch with the fact that her sexuality is totally dominated by a script, which includes that a man is supposed to make all the decisions, she has to take power in the sexual situation, which is very difficult. And many women find it the most difficult thing to do when they start working on the scripts.
Which probably relates to the new impotency. I mean, if you change your own script, you're going to change his script, whether he wants to change it or not.
The moment women begin to take hold of their own behavior in therapy, it scares the men out of their wits, because they're accustomed by the scripts to be in control at all times, which means that they can make all the moves and all the decisions at their convenience. You know, they, you know, can go ahead when they are ready. Whereas women have to go ahead when the man is ready. It's a very different thing. Women begin to take power, the men begin to get very frightened and definitely develop impotence, as far as I can tell. So then the men have to learn that being in control in a sexual situation is not all that exciting, and that there's also excitement in being passive, and that it's okay not to always have an erection, and so on and so forth.
There's a wonderful new book out by the National Lampoon called The Job of Sex. And one of the chapters in there is on feigning an erection. It's a marvelous
feigning
book. Feigning an erection.
Oh, feigning an erection.
It's a fantastic book. It treats Alex Comfort's books exactly from the capitalistic industrial revolution concept. And in every illustration, the guy has a hat on. He's nude, but he has a hat on. It's a terrific book.
A top hat?
No, just a man hat, you know, a snap brim 1950 hat on. I enjoyed very much talking with you. My guest today has been Claude Steiner, author of Scripts People Play, Transactional Analysis. What did I say?
People live.
Scripts.
That's a confusion that people
have. Maybe it's a Freudian slip on my part.
No, it's. Scripts, I mean, the title live. Comes from, is patterned after games people play, so very often people will.
Well, it's Scripts, People Live, Transactional Analysis of Life, Scripts, and it's published by Grove Press, and you can get it at your nearest bookstore, I presume.
It's really good, and it's been very well distributed, so it's there.
Well, thank you very much.